Welcome to the Adonis Lifestyle Podcast. I'm John Barbin, and with me is a good friend, Jeff Dover. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Exercise Science at Concordia University. He's got extensive knowledge with exercise, I guess, rehab and what I guess what specifically was your research in?
It was in I study why some people feel more pain than others. So it's because you notice that some people at the gym when they work out, like, you get sore, and it's just typical of what you feel, and other people really complain about the soreness. And so we're trying to study why some people have more, you know, if they actually are feeling more pain, or there's more pain being generated in their muscles than others.
Okay, that's great. And I just never actually knew how to say exactly what you're
saying. Yeah, it's okay.
Well, but I just want to make sure everyone has an idea. But today's podcast is about the peer review process, and Jeff knows a lot about this because he does some reviewing of papers, and I'm trying to show you guys the difference between going to buy a book at Chapters and what goes into getting a book published in Chapters versus what you read on a blog or an ebook versus an actual scientific paper, and the kind of the review process a piece of scientific research has to go through in order to make its way into an actual peer-reviewed journal. And once I get by the end of this, you'll have a better appreciation of what really there's a huge difference when you're looking at a peer-reviewed piece of research versus just a book. And right now they may not seem that different, but by the end of this podcast, hopefully you'll realize how massively different that really is. And you know, Jeff, you and I, we were talking about this before, it's specifically with strength and conditioning and kind of fitness. You brought up a point that I hadn't even considered it the way you said it, but up until, 10, 15 years ago, there wasn't really any major strength and conditioning journals, especially the specific journal, the Journal of Strength and Conditioning. So it's very recent and very new for a lot of actual published research in that field to be available. So 20, 30 years ago, most of what strength and conditioning coaches were doing were just going off of what they used to do with no real published research to sort of draw from, but rather just what they did as athletes and any information they picked up along the way.
Yeah, no, very true. And they have the journals, the two main ones, the Journal of Strength and Conditioning and then Strength and Conditioning Research. Those are two journals that they're called Index Medicus, which means they're recognized by PubMed, which is the major search engine for research for health science research, right? Mm-hmm. So those journals became what they call Index Medicus, meaning that PubMed recognized them about 10, 15 years ago for the first time, mm-hmm. right? And so why don't we start talking about the so you're right. So that access that information before then, like if you went to search for the stuff, it wouldn't have even been listed, mm-hmm. You know, up until that point, right? So now anyone that has access to PubMed can search and find articles, or at least abstracts in the Journal Strength and Conditioning Research and Journal of Strength and Conditioning. Mm-hmm. So the Journal of Strength and Conditioning, that's the one that's officially backed, like that's the official journal of the NSCA, right? Which is what that's the one that does a certification for certified strength and conditioning.
Mm-hmm. Specialists. National Strength and Conditioning Association, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the one that's the most recognized, at least in North America, you know, as far as training and conditioning. So let's talk a little bit about the peer review process first, then we can talk more about the journals, because I think there's more interesting stuff about that. So let's say, for example, if I'm a professor and I'm doing some research and I find, you know, I have some athletes, we're doing a new workout routine, and we measure their strength before and after, and we see that it goes up, and, you know, that's something we want to publish in a journal. Mm-hmm. So I will write all that down in a manuscript, and I submit it to a journal. And there's some rights that go with that. Like at that point, I'm only allowed to submit it to one journal at a time. And they have full at the point that I submit it, they have all the access rights to that material. So I can't share that material with anyone else while the journal has it.
So at that point, you actually have to choose the journal. Can you explain how people even choose which journals submit to and how it?
Sure. Yeah. Everyone has a different opinion on this, but generally what you do is that when you're writing the article, you have to reference certain things in other journal articles. And so it's whichever journal you reference the most, typically is the one that you submit to because it makes the most sense, right? Like if I'm using a lot of references from the Journal of Strength and Conditioning, you know, then I'll, it would make sense, like whatever I'm doing, if I'm referencing a lot of them, you know, from them, that it would make sense that that's the journal I would want to send it to, because that's the area I'm in. But each journal has a little bit different area. Like there's a, you know, surgeons submit articles to Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery because they're the ones that read it. And, mm-hmm. You know, I would submit an article if I have an interesting athletic therapy article, I would send it to the Journal of Athletic Training because that's athletic therapists read that journal. You know what I mean? So like
there needs to be a fit.
Yeah, it's a combination of readership but fit, like scientifically, like where, you know, why you're sending it there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I'm going to send the manuscript in and they'll take my name off it and then they'll send it to experts in the area. So they have each journal has a list of reviewers, and each reviewer indicates what areas they have expertise in. And those reviewers, you have to interview essentially for the position, and then they'll either make you a reviewer or not.
To be a reviewer. Now, can you touch on what type of expertise you're talking about?
Yeah, sure. So like typically what happens is that once you submit a paper to a journal and if it gets published, you know, then that means like it was good enough for you, you know, for it to get published, and, you know, is that you were a good enough writer. And so sometimes they'll contact you afterwards saying, like, we like your paper. Would you care to be a reviewer in the future for this journal? You know, and then they'll ask you what your expertise are in.
Mm-hmm.
And you're pretty specific with that. So, like, I would say stuff like I'm very familiar with EMG activity in muscles, measuring pain, dysfunction, you know, things like that. And so they'll usually have, like, a drop-down menu, and you just pick the areas that you're comfortable with.
And then if you get accepted as a reviewer, they would have you in their list of people who could review papers within your area of expertise. But just because you're at that level doesn't mean you can review a paper, say, on you know, the effects of carbohydrates on muscle. Even though you're a PhD expert in sort of exercise phys, that gets quickly divided and drilled down into super specific areas.
Yes, and they're very specific. Like they have, like I even indicate, like what, you know, I'm comfortable with certain muscles and not with others, right? Like in certain areas, I'm really comfortable with the knee and the shoulder, but if someone wanted to do like a trunk muscle type study, like it would probably go to someone else. I probably wouldn't get that because that's not close enough to my area. So the papers I get from these journals to review are usually very bang on to like what I'm studying.
Right. And I just want to stop you there, and I want everyone to really understand what you just said. You're an expert in literally certain muscles, but not all muscles.
Yeah.
And you're in the Department of Exercise Science, you're assistant professor, all that kind of stuff. And people don't realize that it still subdivides. Like, you know, we have mm-hmm. friends in doing this type of research at University of Waterloo who happen to be Tyson and Rob and some of the others who do happen to be experts in the muscles of the lower back and the, mm-hmm. in the abs and the trunk. But like you said, I mean, it gets that specific.
Yeah, they have, each journal has hundreds of reviewers
mm-hmm.
typically. So that's the, you know, because that makes it that, you know, that you'll get the better feedback on the article, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point with the peer review process, I submit the manuscript in, they take my name off it, and then they submit it to these reviewers who are experts in the field. And usually they have to be experts in a couple of things. Like they'll be experts in the measurement techniques mm-hmm. that are indicated in the paper, or the subject area, and then the content, of course, like of the actual manuscript. So like there'll be a few things that they'll put into that, to decide like the reviewer.
Mm-hmm.
So there'll be always more than one reviewer will review the paper. It'll be anywhere from a minimum two, but I've had up to six reviewers for one paper before.
Wow.
And what they'll do is they'll send it out to six, you know, anywhere from two to six people. You'll have a 6 weeks to review the paper typically. And then you make your comments and you have general comments and then you have line by line comments. So my general comments are usually stuff like the paper was done well, you know, I liked how they picked their subjects, you know, but I have a real problem with the whole, you know, stats analysis section. And then I'll explain like what I thought went wrong with it or something. And if it's essentially journals are looking for a fatal flaw, right? Like if there's something that was done incorrectly that's bad enough that they can warrant the paper not getting published. And then after the general comments come the specific comments. So that'll be stuff like, you know, this sentence is anywhere from grammar type stuff to also, like, in this sentence you indicate previous studies that looked at shoulder pain, like, why didn't you include this other study?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this sentence you indicate you had 10 people, like, why didn't you use more? So it's a general comment and a line by line breakdown. And, trust me, they're very picky mm-hmm. when it comes, you know, they literally look at each individual sentence and make comments on it and then send it to you. And so then as an author, I will get the edit, I will get those comments back to me. I won't know who wrote them, but, they'll just say reviewer one, reviewer two, reviewer three, whatever.
Right.
And they'll have the general comments and then the line by line comments. And then the editor of the journal will say, you know, these are the comments and, you know, do you think you can make the changes, essentially? And then they'll make a decision on the manuscript, and it'll either be like it's flat out rejected because of what the comments they said, or they'll say like, if you can make these changes, like we'll consider it again. Or every now and then you'll get like, everyone liked it and, you know, we're going to publish the paper, which that almost never happens, right?
Because, right.
Because there's so many things that you can look at.
So can you walk us through, or at least give an example of the type of things that can be changed and bring
sure.
it up, bring it up to snuff,
yeah.
and then compare that to the type of thing that gets a paper flat out rejected, like your methods
Perfect.
Are fatally
yeah,
flawed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there's a couple things that you can look at so many things with an actual paper, right? So sometimes, the things that can be changed, there's stuff like, you know, previous studies have looked at, the number of reps to increase hypertrophy, right? And someone will have a couple of references, but they'll miss some key ones. And so that's something that's, you know, and a reviewer will say, like, this person had the landmark study in that area. Like, why didn't you include it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's easy to add, right? Or at the end, they'll be like, you know, you've talked about how your conclusions, you know, let's say you came up with an intervention to increase anaerobic sprinting. Like, it's a way to run faster, to sprint faster. And then maybe in your discussion you talked about how that might influence aerobic capacity. And they'll be like, well, that's sort of outside your scope. I mean, you only measured anaerobic stuff, so take that out of the discussion because, you know, you can only generalize to anaerobic stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, those are things that are like, you know, that they're doable, right? Like, you can make those changes. An example of stuff that can't, that are, you know, that, like, fatal flaw stuff would be like if someone had, a good one is a supplement, right? So, like, they're like, we had 10 people come in, we gave them the supplement, you know, they exercised afterwards, and all of them had a significant increase in strength. You know, or what a reviewer would say, or what I would say, would be like, there's no control group, and we know that the placebo effect has a significant effect, especially with supplements, so you can't conclude that your supplement worked because we don't know if it would have, like, if a placebo would have done the same thing,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's an example of something like they can't fix that. Like, they would have to go back and either get the same people and do it all with the placebo, or do the whole study again with a separate group, right?
And just to let people know, there is no doing the whole study again. Like, it's once it's done, like.
You can. I mean,
well,
theoretically, you could. But
theoretically,
like,
you could. But the way funding works out, like, the study's already been funded. Like, if you make a mistake like that, you really botched it.
Yeah, no, you really botched it, and you have to answer something again, you know? But, like, for example, I talked to a colleague of mine the other day. He had a group, they were looking at a tactile sensation type test, and they had a group like with no sensation and a group with some, and the reviewers wanted like an in-between group, like a group with like really mild sensation or something like that. And so that was just, you know, they were going to have to find more people and test them, but like that can be done, right?
Oh, and continue the study. I guess it's dependent on funding and availability.
So, but it all depends, right? Like, that study was flat out rejected, but they're like, if you test more people, like, then we'll consider it.
Mm-hmm.
But something like the supplement thing, like, you can't go back in time now, like, and administer the drug to the same people, like, again, or,
right, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, so it's situational. It's case by case.
Yeah, each paper is different. But the key thing here is that they're experts in the area, also with the measurement technique, and that's really important, right? So, for example, if I got a paper, you know, compared to, like, the average person reading it, right? If someone said, we use EMG, you know, and we collected it at this frequency, and we noticed that there was a muscle delay of like 30 milliseconds, you know, therefore, you know, the muscle doesn't come in on time, you know, with this type of intervention. Reading it, I'm like, you know what, I know if, because I've used that equipment before, and I know that if I collected at that frequency, I can't measure differences that are that small, that are 30 milliseconds in length. Mm-hmm. So that's a specific case where I'm like, I don't know, you know, explain to me how you got that measurement, because I know that with that frequency, it doesn't, it's not that accurate.
It's kind of like trying to measure the difference. It's kind of like trying to measure the difference of an inch, but only using a yardstick to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? So, like, it's, you know, and these are, because there's some really specific equipment out there. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the difference between, you know, if you're trying to measure the difference in sprint time and you were using a handheld stopwatch instead of a laser time, right? Like, it, you know, the difference you're going to be measuring is in milliseconds, which is bigger than the standard error of using a handheld stopwatch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's another, like, that's another key with the experts, right? Is that not only are they good at, like, typically they're good at, like, you know, the, why you're doing the study and how they're measuring it, but, like, also the specific methods and the equipment, right? They'll be able to answer questions on that than the average person would know.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get those comments back, and if you address the comments and you send it back to the journal, and then the editor will decide if, like, they'll publish it then, or sometimes they'll send it to the same reviewers again. And they'll decide if you've addressed the comments enough. And then you'll get it back. And they'll either say, like, no, you still haven't addressed the comments, or they'll say it's flat out rejected, or they'll say, like, yes, you've made enough changes, and, you know, therefore we'll accept it now with only minor revisions. So even then, it's journals tend to now have a two submission maximum. Like, if you have to submit it again, then that means, like, you haven't addressed it enough. Or they'll just decide it, like, they'll be able to tell from the beginning that this will take more than two revisions, so they'll just reject it from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to get something published, you know, like, it's not easy, because there's a lot of people to look at it, and there's a lot of, people can get hung up on the wrong stuff too, right? Like, they can, I submitted a paper before where we only looked at males, because the data at that point hadn't been, you know, we didn't know if it was going to have the same effect in females or not. So to decrease that variability, like, we just use males. And then one of the reviewers had a big problem with that. It was like, now we can't generalize it to males and females. And I'm like, no, we can't. But in order to answer the question, we just wanted to do this. And it was, he wouldn't let go of that idea, or she, I don't know who it was, mm-hmm. but it was, that was something that the editor had to decide on. So,
and that was never even your intention at all.
No, like, it was not even, you know, so, like, it's tough getting things in there. So to put it in perspective, when you submit, like, let's say you came up with a great training protocol and you wanted to submit it to, you know, like a magazine, right? Like Flex Magazine or something.
Mm-hmm.
Then you submit it to them and there's no one reviews it. Right? Like, the editor will just make sure that it's, like, spelled correctly and stuff, but that's about it. And then it gets published.
And then it's a catchy
read. In the magazine. And it that hasn't been reviewed at all.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
No,
so, like, there might be methodological problems with it, or they might not have done it properly, that the average person might not know about, right? Like, with the control group or with the placebo. You know, and then that way, like, you know, you'll read it, then you'll sort of assume that it's accurate, but it might not be, because there's no double checking on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a good point to mention too, the problem with sort of like anecdotal research, because that's one of the main problems between peer-reviewed and non-peer-reviewed stuff, is that the weakest type of evidence we have to see if something really works, because that's what you want to know, right? Like, does this supplement really work? Does this type of training program really work? Like, that's what I want to know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the weakest evidence we have for that stuff is called anecdotal like evidence, which is essentially one person, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a guy, you know, I gave him this training program, and oh man, you should see him now. Like, he's significantly mm-hmm. stronger and everything, and he's a monster, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd be like, oh man, if that worked for him, like, I want to do it. But you don't know, like, there's so many factors that could have affected it. Like, it could be just he went from not working out at all to doing something to... could be anything, right? So that's why the best way to see, you know, if something really worked is that you do it in a group of people, you compare it to a group of people who are not doing it, you know, and that's, and researchers know that, right? So when you submit, you know, like, if you try to submit that, to the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research say, like, hey, I got this great program, I did it on this guy, and he's, like, really strong now, like, they would immediately reject it, because they'd be like, well, we don't know, you know, we have no one to compare it to, we don't have a control group, we don't, you know what I mean? Like, they wouldn't even review it, like, the editor would just send it back without even...
And they're going to reject it. Sure, and they're going to check to see if it's done in a research facility that has some kind of ethics review that, and that people are trying to do this research on the up and up and not kind of fudge the numbers.
Yeah,
because
there's a certain amount of, you know, honor involved with like what you submit, right? And the journal has a way of, like they, it's more authentic than with a magazine. Like you could never. You know, you might not ever even talk to the editor at the magazine and they'll just email them an article, right? But at least with there's correspondence with the reviewer and the editor and, you know, like
it's a different group of people and they make their money a different way. The magazine editor's job is to publish stuff that on a monthly basis is catchy and interesting to read, not difficult to read, that the layperson can get through front to back and be like entertained and maybe pull a little bit of quote information out of it. Whereas in the scientific review process, that stuff is that's the quote seeking of knowledge, so to speak. And it's written kind of from scientists for scientists to further science. And there's a bit of a gap between that information and the stuff that makes its way to the average person. Because the average person cannot read a scientific paper if they're not trained to.
No.
They have no idea what it's saying.
That's true.
You know, the conclusion in an abstract is irrelevant if the methods weren't done correctly and the statistics weren't done correctly. And I don't know if you – let's touch on this for a bit. Not all journals are equal, and not all published papers are equal. And I don't know that people realize a paper can be published that still isn't of high quality, so to speak.
So a good way to look at this is something called impact factor. Each journal is ranked with a number. The higher the number, the better. And that number is called the impact factor, right? So, for example, the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, the impact factor is 1.4. And that's not bad. And what that number means, it's a formula that they use to generate it. And it's based on how many articles they publish and how many times they're cited. So you could imagine if someone's doing research on, like, the cure for cancer and they found it, you know, hypothetically, like if it was some sort of, you know, pill or something, that article would be cited a million times, right? Because everyone would also be doing studies on it. And they would always reference that article as like the first one that found it. So to give you an idea, again, like 10 years ago, the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research did not have an impact. It didn't have a number. Like it wasn't even recorded. And now it's 1.4, which isn't bad. It's ranked 34 out of 72 journals in the sports sciences. So it's in the, you know, top half, which is good. Like that there's a lot of journals in there. And so so that means that out of all the articles that they're publishing, people are citing them, meaning like, I've looked at that article and like, you know, that had a really good program and so now I'm trying to look at this or another type of question. So that really gives you an idea of, you know, that the stuff in there is pretty good if people are citing it. If it's a bad article, then no one's going to reference it.
Because reviewers will have gone through it or other researchers who are looking around doing some research will look through it and go, oh yeah, these methods aren't that good or the conclusions aren't, and then it kind of gets left behind it slowly just loses its sort of, even though it's published and it's sitting somewhere, it's of no real value to move to that area of science. So I'm just trying to get the point across that stuff that's published doesn't mean it's as good as something else that's published.
No, but I mean, I still feel like it's way better than anything that's like published in a non-peer-reviewed source, right?
Oh, 100%.
And anything that's been published in a peer-reviewed source is way better than like something you get at
a magazine
or something like that. But you're right. There are like some journals are better than others, and you can tell when you read them. Like I can tell when I read them. Like out of a good journal, it'll be written better. The study will be done better. Compared to like a journal, like a not as good journal. But, now the problem with this also is that, like, there's a lot of clinicians that are gonna read Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, right? Like, there'll be a lot of track coaches and things like that that'll read it that they're not conducting research, right? So, the people who are reading it might not be doing a lot of research and therefore not citing the material. So that's part of the reason why the impact factor isn't higher, is because the part of the readership isn't in academia, mm-hmm. versus something like, journals that look at the pig genome, will have like a really high impact factor because there's a ton of people studying that, but everyone studying it is also conducting research, right? So like those seem to be higher, but mm-hmm. the clinical journals sometimes are a little bit less, but that's just because some of the people reading them don't publish they're not working in academia.
Well, they're almost like, they're just going to take it and actually apply some of it and not,
yeah, exactly.
use it for another piece of research. Yeah.
That's right. So I think another thing to point out, which I thought was good too, with the whole peer review process is, and getting information from a peer review process versus somewhere else, is the lag in time. So for example, the NSCA, the Essentials of Strength and Conditioning, that textbook that they have, it's a new one, the latest edition came out a couple of years ago, and a colleague of mine that teaches a class, and uses that book, he commented on how identical the book is to the previous one, which was like 8 years ago. Mm. And so that, implies that nothing has changed in like 10 years, give or take, right? As far as strength and conditioning information. And, which is clearly not the case, right? Like there's thousands of millions of people out there doing research on strength and conditioning type stuff all the time. And it's just that it takes a lot of time to consolidate information and put it into a textbook. So the articles are the best and most recent source of information, mm-hmm. like peer-reviewed articles are the most recent and best source of information now that you can get. And there's so many people out there studying stuff. Like if you were interested in, training for a marathon or, how to improve my bench press or something like that, there's articles out there that are in peer-reviewed articles that people have studied that stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can look at it and it's it's the best research we have out there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that time frame is important because it takes a while for the books to change.
Mm-hmm. But for the textbooks the articles undergraduate curriculum and like position statements from those organizations where you go on their website mm-hmm. and they're like, this is our position on this or that. But those things at least with online they can their websites can be updated a little quicker, but to get it into curricula and into the kind of mass consciousness of people who are entering those fields, as maybe undergrads who are looking to move on, it takes time. And like you said, and I think you can get even more up to date. So the journals are happening quicker than any textbook. But if you can ever get yourself to a conference, you can actually speak with these researchers and find out what they're studying like right now, like what they were doing a week ago in their lab, and that stuff. Correct me if I'm wrong, that stuff won't even be into the peer review process until, 8, 12, 15 months into the future. But you can kind of poke at them and get them to tell you what they're in the middle of. And even though it's not reviewed yet, they're like, wow, these are the sort of results we seem to be getting right now. So if you can ever find yourself to one of these conferences, you can really find out what's happening like right now. Because research that gets published today, that shows up in the journal today, was done, a year ago, a year and a half ago maybe?
Yeah, usually it'd probably even be submitted up to like 8 months ago. So if it's submitted 8 months ago, then it was probably completed like 16 months ago.
Mm-hmm. So you and I could be in your lab studying some new exercise technique, a supplement or something. We could be doing the research today and be almost done finishing collecting the data on all of our subjects. But the world, quote, the world won't see it in a reviewed paper until almost 2 years from now.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, if we were finishing a study today, I'd like to get the paper out and in print, within a year, but it max 2 years. But either way, you're right. There's a delay. It's not fast.
So it's still faster
than textbooks. If you think of the third edition of that book hasn't changed significantly from the second edition, right? Mm-hmm.
That's even slower.
That's 8 years, right? The conference, you have a really good point about the conference because you can submit an abstract, which is also peer reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And then that gets presented, but then obviously it takes longer for the whole paper, to be accepted. But that's the best source of information we have out there.
As far as being completely up to date. So unless you actually have access to people like yourself where you can just call them up and say, hey, what are you up to? People won't realize what's actually been figured out to this point. There's, like you said, there's various levels of delay. So if you've taken an undergrad course in this stuff, based mm-hmm. on what the textbooks say and how much extra sort of supplemental information your professors decide to add in or not, or if they just go straight from textbook, you could be getting, for lack of a better way of saying it, 5 to 8 years outdated information.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. And they give you a specific example. What in my class that happened like this semester, we do, we're talking about injuries and how to rehab them, and tendonitis came up. And I mentioned to them that tendonitis doesn't exist anymore. It's called tendinopathy now, and tendonitis doesn't, like, it's considered an inflammation condition, right? Mm-hmm. Like anything that ends in itis means inflamed. Mm-hmm. And there's actually, they've done enough studies now where they dissect tendons that are, you know, quote unquote, have tendonitis, and there's not a single inflammation marker on them. Mm-hmm. So it's a degeneration disease. It's not inflammation. So like putting ice on it and stuff is not going to help it, because it's degenerated. The only thing that's going to help it is exercise. Mm. Which is sort of counterintuitive to like an inflammation condition.
That's a massive paradigm shift.
So it's a huge shift, right? And so no one from starting like now, no one calls it tendonitis anymore. It's just tendinopathy is what they call it. And we treat it differently.
Whoa, back up. Right when you said no one, you mean no one who's in the know.
Yes.
I'd say 99.999% of the population still believe tendonitis exists.
And all the books, all the textbooks say that, right? Mm-hmm. They're all saying like, this is how you treat tendonitis. But the next editions that come out, like, they won't say that anymore. It'll be tendinopathy. Mm-hmm. But, like, that's going to take some time, right? So these are the kind of examples of things, you know, that, like, that's why it's so important to keep up with this. And, like, you made a good point about the undergrad curriculum, right? Because they are, you know, as teachers, we have a hard time. We got to decide, like, you know, what do they need to know? Like, what would I like to teach? What, you know, how current is it? How advanced can we get? Or do they have the foundation yet? And that's why people use textbooks a lot, because it's, you know, it walks you through it. Mm-hmm. But any good course, and especially at the graduate level, they almost never use textbooks now. It's mostly course packs or articles, because so much stuff has been done with this that, you know, and it changes so fast that there's no point in using a book. Like, you may as well just use the best material is just a peer-reviewed journal article.
Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know if this is my own personal bias based on our generation, but it seems as though from when I was an undergrad to now, research is going like lightning fast with the way information can be like disseminated. I mean, when I started undergrad, there wasn't really the internet. What was a 486 was the fastest computer. I remember a university library was still a card catalog. Like, things are going so fast, the information's aggregating so fast.
At risk of making us sound old, we didn't have the internet when we went to university. And to be honest, the faculty and researchers were handled different too. Like, at the, you know, my teachers, when I was at Guelph and when I, like, even when I was down at Florida, like, when they were students, their faculty, like, if it was, you'd apply for a grant, that was great. If you got it, that's great. If you didn't, like, that's okay too. They were just happy if you applied for one. Mm-hmm. And then if you published a couple of papers, they'd be happy with that. And it is so different now. Like, you have to bring in money. You have to bring in a lot of money, and you have to publish a lot of papers. And everyone's doing this now.
And it's,
so you
can
imagine,
there's
more people doing it, and they have to do more of it, right? So there's this been exponential increase. I was at the University of Florida for 9 years, and my first year there, the university as a whole brought in a little over $100 million in funding, like for research. And in my last year there, they brought in around $600 million in 1 year for research. So like, it's going up exponentially. So like, the amount of research you can get done with $600 million is a lot more than $100 million, right? Mm-hmm. So think about all those people and all those papers that are being submitted for the peer review process, like, and every institution is doing this, not at the same level, but every university in Canada and the States, like, they're putting an emphasis on research. So all those people now are submitting papers, you know, to get looked at. So there's people looking at everything. Like, mm-hmm. there's another paper that I showed to my class this year, was this guy, he came up with a balancing program to decrease ankle sprains in soccer players. And so for 20 minutes before you do your warm-up, before every practice and every game, there's sort of this balancing program that you do. and it decreased, it cuts the incidences of ankle sprains by half. So imagine if you're working with a pro soccer team or something and you tell the coach, like, you know, you could do, if we implement this program, we're going to have half as many ankle sprains. Like, that's amazing, right?
Especially with, like, high-priced athletes.
Yeah, he did it with hundreds of athletes. He did it across, like, an entire soccer league, right? So we had half the people do the program and half the people didn't, and that's how he could measure the ankle sprains, right? Mm. And that's new. It just came out, like, a year or so ago, and that's not going to be in any book anytime soon, right? Like, that's the, you know, that's just a new article right now that we can, you know, that, like, and the program's in the article, so you can download the article and implement it if you worked with a soccer team, so, you know?
Mm.
So that's the speed that this stuff is going, and the specific question that they're looking at is unbelievable.
Yeah, because you like, for instance, that example you just gave, there's no guarantee that that same protocol would work, say, for football.
No.
Because you're not...
Like, and you have to, you know, like, it's... Like, was it done in healthy people? Were any injured people, you know, part of the study or not? Like, there's other... Obviously, there's things you need to look at, but, like, just that I... You know, like, just that idea is how fast something could be tested and implemented and then put in a paper.
And then broadcasted to whoever can come, can find it.
There's access to the internet. Like, it really is unlimited. It's really changed my teaching. I know that. Like, a lot of my students bring laptops to class now, and we'll be talking about something and they'll be like, oh, like, have you heard, you know, what about this test? And I'm like, oh, I'm not familiar with it. And then 5 seconds later, someone starts reading it out, and they're like, oh, it's on Wikipedia. Like, they're reading out the definition right there. And so it's really changed a lot in terms of me in teaching, because, like, I have to be up on everything. Otherwise, someone's going to look it up in class. So, like, it's really changed. And that wasn't like it for us. Like,
when
we went to school, you know, like, and professors, like, they could tell you stuff from the textbook or, that you like, and we had no way of really checking it, right? But now
you're
like,
actually being held accountable.
I could tell you, like, 3 sets of 10 is the best way to increase strength. And while you're sitting there listening to me, you can look on PubMed and see if I'm right. Like, you could find a peer-reviewed article from a strength and conditioning journal article, and see if, like, if they say, like, well, this article found something else, right? Like, that way of finding information and good information. Is been unprecedented.
So it's going to force people in your position to be really on the ball and more accountable for what you're teaching.
Absolutely, because you can find these articles and come back. Like, if I tell someone that this supplement doesn't work and they go out and find an article that does, and that takes them about 10 seconds, right? That I'm going to have to explain why I said that. Which this access of knowledge is. It's unprecedented. And I'll tell you, where it affects it is in exercise is compliance, right? Because we had, I've worked at a place before where the swimming coach once a week would take the whole team out and do like a 45-minute jog. And the coach thought it was really good to do cross training, right? And my thought was like, what the hell does that have to do with swimming, right? Like, is that nothing you get from a once a week 45-minute jog is going to help you in the pool, right? Like, that's ridiculous. And so, and we know this. The body is so specific, like, in how it trains and how it adapts that something like that is, like, would never work. It's like running on a treadmill for, like, a race that's going to be on land. Like, we know that it
doesn't translate.
People have studied that stuff, right? You could find an article that says, like, you know, you train on the treadmill, but your VO2max doesn't change on land and stuff. And so, you know, all of a sudden, like, that coach has these athletes running around, and the athlete shows up with a specificity article, like, showing evidence, peer-reviewed evidence that, you know, running on land doesn't help with your swimming, you know, aerobic capacity. Like, what are you going to say to that? Like, you're going to have to come up with a reason, right? So it does. I think just the access to that, to good information is really changing how people are handling stuff.
So, well, that was, man, we covered a lot of stuff. I think we can wrap this up. But in general, the final point that we never really touched on is the difference between a peer-reviewed paper and a book, like a book that does still cite research, like the type of book you could buy at a bookstore, like on a diet mm-hmm. or something like that. Books in bookstores are not peer-reviewed as to this rigorous degree the way Jeff just explained. A book in a bookstore is a deal between the author and the publishing house to write a book that can keep the customer's attention. First of all, it can get someone to convert from being a browser to a customer. So the book has to have a catchy title, an interesting topic, and a hook, some kind of hook that gets your attention. None of this has anything to do with it being scientifically valid. It can be the most harebrained, ridiculous, you know, the diet that came from Mars. It doesn't matter about scientific validity at all. As long as it's catchy and it gets you to pull out the credit card and buy it, that's all the publisher cares about. And another big important thing is they're hoping that it's catchy enough that you'll be interested in the second and third edition of the whatever said diet or said program, you know, was talking about. So again, none of this goes through scientific review. It doesn't matter if 100 studies are cited. They're not. The person who wrote the book doesn't have to have intimate knowledge of any of those studies the way Jeff would have of EMG and the various techniques that he understands. So the point is, anyone can throw in 100 references to studies that they know nothing about, and that's essentially what you get when you read a book from the bookstore. So especially when it comes to things like diet, exercise, physiology, things about your body, that couldn't be any further from the accuracy and the validity of an actual peer-reviewed piece of research. So I'm just trying to impress upon you, when you buy a book at the store, it's nothing like even one's – it has nothing even remotely close to the scientific and accountability and vigorous review that even one paper has.
Yeah, here's how I would explain it, right? When you write a book, the rules that govern what you can say in that book are the same for – like Stephen King, who's writing a fiction-like novel, right? Like, so there's
there are none.
Yeah,
we
have a freedom. You can write a book of poetry, right, or creative writing, or make up a story, or whatever. Like,
aliens,
and we're allowed to do that because we have freedom of speech. We can be creative and however we want. So that book is held by those standards, right? They're held by creative writing standards.
Mm-hmm.
Versus a peer-reviewed journal article is held to scientific standards. That's the difference, right?
Like you That's a huge difference. Let me work off of that point. There are people who have written books about how to lose weight and things like that who have been sued for fraudulent claims.
Exactly.
And what they had to do is on the very first page of the book, they had one little paragraph disclosure or disclaimer that said, oh, these are just my opinions, or these are just – you know, everything in this book is just based on my opinion, my recollection, and it's just a fictional story. And then the rest of the book the rest of the 200 pages of the book are detailed rules on how to lose weight, detailed rules on how this person says the body works, and like do this, not that, exercise this way, eat this, not that, it's, you know, ultra complex. But the thing is, legally, this guy has every right to say it because at the very, very beginning of the book, his lawyers consulted with, you know, whoever he needed to talk to, and they were like, no, as long as you explain that this is completely your opinion, the rest of the book can sound as factual and rule driven as you want it. But if it's in a scientific peer review process, you'd just be told to get out. But in on a book on the shelf, you know, about the miracle weight loss and the miracle cure to everything, you need one little paragraph disclosing that, no, I'm just exercising my right to express my opinion under the freedom of speech rules.
Yeah, well, I mean, I keep coming back to the fiction. You know, it's funny because when you read something like, you know, a couple of guys fighting with lightsabers, you'd be like, oh, that could never happen, right? But then if it's someone's writing about like what you can eat and what you can't, you'd be like, well, that makes sense. You know, like that, and it is, for some reason you take it with that it's more serious than it isn't, but they're held by the same rules, you know. And, you know, just one last thing too about the publishing, which I thought was which is an interesting point, is that there's some journals that are so, like like you said, the book, they care about the money and selling and stuff like that, but the journals don't, because they don't make every paper they print, like they don't get more money for it, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, it costs them money to print a bigger journal with more articles, so they want to be really selective. They're proud of rejecting, like there's this one journal that rejects 90% of all their manuscripts that come in, right? And they're proud of that number. They're like, it's hard to get in here, and the people who do publish in there walk around with their chest puffed out a little bit because, like, it's hard to get in there.
In academic circles.
In academic circles. Well, yes, exactly.
It's not like they're walking up and down the beach saying, I just got...
Yeah, I wouldn't try to meet girls that way, you know, like tell them what journal you've published in, but whatever, you know, different strokes. But
and then you drop the impact factor line on them and take off. Well, that's
if she is interested, I'd be kind of like looking at her going like, what's your problem? But no, but anyway, but they had, what to give you an idea, like I've worked with some really successful researchers and very good professors that bring in lots of millions of dollars in grant money, publish lots of papers, and there's a handful of journals that are just awesome with like impact factors that are really high. And I remember mentioning this to one professor one time. I'm like, oh man, could you imagine getting something published in Science? And he looked at me, that's Science is the name of a journal, it's one of the best journals out there. And he looked at me, and this guy, he's the most successful professor I know, and he looked at me and he stopped and he put his pen down. And he's like, oh man, Jeff, he's like, if I could get one thing published in Science, he's like, that would be the best thing in my career. And I was like, wow, like this guy has everything in my opinion, like research money, and he's written textbooks and everything, but he's like, he's nowhere close to getting something published in a certain journal. And that's like, that still makes him pause when I'm talking to him in his office, like he's so, that's just such a big deal. Like it's publishing where and if you can publish is a really big deal. So
that's the equivalent of him winning the MVP or the,
yeah,
the sport.
Like that's the, and it's funny because it'd be like hearing it from, you know, an athlete that's, or someone that's, you know, like really successful, but that just haven't won a World Series or something. And you'd be like, wow, but aren't you happy? Like you got everything else, right? Like there's, you know, 30 teams don't win the World Series every year, right? Like, you know, like if you kind of have to be, you'd be happy just to be there. But he's, you know, like that it's a really big deal where it goes into.
Yeah. So, well, and so I guess we could wrap it up now. So that's, and obviously this discussion could go on for like another 5 hours. There's so many more things we could talk about. But in general, the closing point, and I'll let you have your closing points in a sec. There's a huge difference between an academic, scientific, peer-reviewed paper and the rigors that it goes through before it even gets published. So before you even have a chance to see it, it's been – the people who wrote it have been held to quite a high standard, and it just does not end up on a piece of – it does not end up published if it doesn't have some degree of credibility to it. And that is just night and day compared to stuff you read – online in a magazine, a book in a bookstore. Like Chapters is not peer reviewed stuff, but those are just like Jeff said, that the fiction and then the how to diet section are held to the same standard.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's when you read a peer reviewed article, it's been reviewed by multiple people who do the same type of research and who have no vested interest in whether or not that gets published or not. Mm-hmm. Right? So, like, it's not like they get any more money or they don't, they get no benefit from it at all. So, like, it's pure science that gets chosen to be put in there. And so that, as far as, like, if you had to pick something to read and say, like, this is something I want to give a try, you know, like, the peer-reviewed article would be it.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess we'll follow up on a later point. I'll have to cover how hard it is to actually even read a paper, and if you're not trained for it, you know, the average person couldn't pick up a paper and make heads or tails of it. You need to be trained in that field.
That'd be a great follow-up podcast if you want. We could talk about how to read we could go over a landmark strength and conditioning article and then go over, pick out the important points from it if you wanted.
Yeah, if you want. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah,
we'd
that'd probably be more interesting than how to pick up journals or how to pick up girls with high impact factors, right? Like that's a better podcast.
Yeah, the utter failure that would turn into. Man. All right. Well, that was great. Thanks for being on. And for Jeff Dover, I'm John Barbin, and that's your Adonis Lifestyle Podcast.